Chinaman stopped it. The one who runs the place. He wasn't fixing to lose his license because a couple of hotheads wanted to mix it up. He made us shake hands. What could I do? Then it's all right. Sure, fine. Just fine. On the way home, they tried to run me down. Coincidence, that's all. I was on the sidewalk, way inside against the buildings, and the car didn't miss me by more than an inch. Oh. Starting the car, Freddy eased it out into the street. He was smiling, fully recovered from his recent flight. Bastards, he muttered. Think they own the country. They better keep out of my way.
They drove for a little while in silence, until they came to a drive-in restaurant. Freddy ordered hamburgers and coffee for the two, and tried to make time with the car hop.
What have you been doing?
Asked Ichiro. Freddy frowned.
You're in a rut. You asked last time.
I guess I did.
Well, I'm still having fun, boy. Living it up.
Still have your poker sessions?
Interested?
A little. Guy's got to do something.
That's tough, said Freddy, not unhappily. I knew you'd come around, but you'll have to fix it up yourself. I don't play no more.
Game's getting too rough?
It's never too rough for me. I like 'em rough. I can't stand them guys.
He spit out the window.
They're all chicken.
The car hop came back and hooked the tray to the door. Freddy ogled her shamelessly. The bill came to 80 cents. He tossed $1.25 on the tray and told her to keep it. She smiled.
I'll make it yet, he said,
handing over a hamburger and coffee to Ichiro.
Nothing like trying.
Boy, said Freddy. She'd be a nice change from the fat pig.
2A?
Yeah,
he replied defiantly.
You got one good memory. You should be a professor.
Your luck's holding.
Itchy boy, you don't know the half of it. I got a silver spoon up my ass. Her old man likes me. Can you beat that?
He indicated the car with a sweep of his arm, throwing bits of relish on the dash.
This is his. Use it, he says, anytime you want.
Doesn't he know?
Freddy bit his lip, suppressing a chuckle.
Sure. I'm doing him a favor. I go bowling on Wednesday nights, he says to me. Saturdays I get together with the boys for a little game. Don't get home till real late. I like movies too, he says. I go a lot to movies. I let you know when I go to the movie, he tells me. You can run me down and use the car. No use letting the car sit outside while I'm in a movie. He don't say he knows, but he knows all right. She was killing him before I moved in. He's a nice guy. Timid, you know. Don't say much, but he's one good Joe.
Screwy.
Huh?
Sounds to me like he's screwy.
He's not screwy enough. That's his trouble.
He laughed loudly, enjoying his own joke immensely. The conversation made him feel a little sick. He stuffed the rest of his hamburger into the coffee cup and reached past Freddy to set it on the tray.
Don't like it? I think it's good.
It is. I'm just not very hungry.
Yeah,
said Freddy, with an obvious effort at sympathy.
It's tough. Guys like you take it hard.
Wouldn't you?
Nah. How's that?
The question seemed to embarrass him for a moment. He twisted uneasily in the seat.
They're old country, he said. They should have never come here. They had no right to come here and born me and try to make me old country too. All that crap about Japan. Japan this, Japan that. Hell, after what they'd done to me, you'd think they'd learn, but no. The stuff they dish out is still the same. Like an albatross round a guy's neck. That's what they are. They sure screwed me up right.
Why don't you move out?
What? I told you I'm living. No rent to pay, plenty to eat, money to spend, a car, a woman. I ain't giving all that up. Besides, their line of crap don't faze me no more. Let them talk. They got nothing else to live for.
You make a lot of sense, Freddy. I never quite thought of it that way.
That way about what?
About their having nothing to live for, except making enough so that they could go back to the old country and be among their own kind and know a little peace and happiness.
No kidding. I said all that?
I thought so.
Maybe I'll go to school, said Freddy. I'm not so dumb.
He looked at Freddy, grinning broadly, and felt sadly cheated. On the surface, there was wit and understanding, and even a rough sort of charm. But one made a mistake in probing underneath. He understood now why Freddy was so constantly concerned with living, as he called it. It was like being on a pair of water skis, skimming over the top, as long as one traveled at a reasonable speed, but the moment he slowed down or stopped, it was to sink into the nothingness that offered no real support.
I'd like to go home, if you don't mind, he said to Freddy.
Sure, sure. Don't blame you. It's tough.
He leaned on the horn, ignoring the prominently displayed signs requesting patrons to blink lights for service. A different car hop scurried over and, eyeing him hatefully, quickly removed the tray.
Anytime, honey,
he hollered at her back. Backing out of the slot, he gunned the car into the street and jarred it over the strip of raised concrete in the middle to avoid having to drive a block to make a U-turn. He drove like a man possessed with a desperate urgency to move fast, covering ground in a frantic pursuit, which was being conducted for the sole purpose of running from reality. To stop and sit would mean to think. Ichiro looked at Freddy and felt these things and was glad for himself that he was bearing the problem inside of him and making an effort to seek even a partial release from it. He could only imagine what Freddy's nights must be like.
Take it easy, he said.
Freddy neither turned his head nor slowed down.
Sure,
he said.
Have you thought any about working?
Nah, ain't got time.
You will eventually.
I'll think about it then.
He waited for a moment before asking the next question.
Any of the fellows working?
You want a job?
I don't have much choice.
Go down that place by the lake. You know the one I mean. Christian Reclamation Center or something. They know about us guys. I went down there.
You?
Yeah, just to see. Me and Gary. They put him on right away. Real nice, them church guys.
What about you?
I told him I'd think about it.
He took one hand off the wheel to light a cigarette.
Gary the only one?
Nah, there's a couple others I don't know.
They working anyplace else?
Mike's old man got a hotel, and Pat's driving truck for some cleaning outfit. Some of the guys are going to school. Just like old times, I tell you.
Doesn't sound too bad.
Sure. Same crummy jobs, same rotten pay. Before the war, the Japs got what the white guys didn't want. Now, if we want work, we take the jobs the good Japs don't want. Gary had a good deal in a foundry. He lasted 10 days.
What happened?
He'll tell you.
I don't expect to see him.
You want to work?
Sure.
I said go to that Christian Center place. Tell him I sent you. You'll see Gary. He likes it there. It's nothing but a big junkyard, and the place is full of drunks and deadbeats and homos. But they don't bother you. They got problems of their own. Gary'll tell you. He likes it.
He didn't mean to sound disappointed, but he couldn't help himself.
Sure,
was all he could manage. in a tone full of uncertainty. Freddy seemed aggravated as he said,
"You asked me, didn't you? You're not doing me a favor. All I said was you want a job? You got one there."
"I guess I'll give it a try tomorrow," he replied, and remained silent until Freddy let him off at the store. There were no lights on, and he felt his way to the kitchen, swinging his arm around until he found the pull chain above the table. His mother was dead, and his father was probably now at the Japanese restaurant, hosting the post-funeral supper, and making the most of being the center of attention. "Enjoy yourself, Pa," he said to himself. "If this is what makes you happy, I guess you've had it coming for a long time. And then, you might be lonesome for her. But with all the people coming and going ever since she died, you haven't had much chance to think about things. Maybe the grief is waiting. Or is it that the grief has finally come to an end for you? It has for me in a way, her being gone. We'll have to talk about it." He set a pot of tea to boil and, while looking for a spoon, came across the old deck of cards with which Taro had been playing solitaire on the afternoon that he had gone from house and family. It was an old deck, limp and greasy, and he had to peel the cards off carefully one at a time. It was better than nothing. For the first time, it occurred to him that there wasn't even a radio in the house. He recalled that he used to listen to the radio a lot when he had been going to school. His mother hadn't liked it. Quite frequently, she would slip into his room where he was studying and listening to Glenn Miller or Tommy Dorsey and firmly switch off the set. Then, when the fellow started to learn how to dance, he got a bit of the fever himself and started to buy an occasional record or two until he had a fair-sized stack. The phonograph player he would borrow and keep a few days or a week at a time. She hadn't approved at all, and that was what had led to the big trouble. At least, it was big then when he couldn't afford the price of a player. He had spent a couple of evenings at home listening to records, and she'd said a few things about wasting time on foolish pursuits. He hadn't paid any attention, of course. He enjoyed listening to the records and saw no harm in them. It was on a Saturday night that he had gone to a dance at the church gym. When he got home, the phonograph was methodically and thoroughly smashed to bits. Nothing had survived. She had even gone to the trouble of snipping each of the innumerable lengths of wire into short pieces no more than an inch or two long. She paid for the player and had the satisfaction of seeing that he borrowed no others. He justly felt after all these years that she had been very unfair. A radio, a record player, even a stack of comic books were small enough concessions. Had she made those concessions, she might have kept her sons a part of the family. Everything, it seemed, stemmed back to her. All she had wanted from America for her sons was an education, learning and knowledge, which would make them better men in Japan. To believe that she expected that such a thing was possible for her sons without their acquiring other American tastes and habits and feelings was hardly possible. And yet, that is how it was. "Tragic," he said silently. "So tragic to have struggled so against such insurmountable obstacles." For her, of course, the obstacles hadn't existed, and it was like denying the existence of America. If only she had tried to understand, had attempted to reason out the futility of her ways. Surely she must have had an inkling during the years. He couldn't be sure and, much as he wished to know where and how the whole business had gone wrong, he could not, for he had never been close enough to his own mother. Thinking that he heard a knocking on the front door, he remained still and listened. It came again, faintly. Hesitantly, he went through the store, wondering who it could be. She had stepped back away from the door, and with the street lamp behind her, shadowing her face, he didn't recognize her immediately.
When he finally realized that it was Emmy, he could only awkwardly motion her inside.
"I heard only tonight," she said. "Mr. Miano read about it in the paper. I am very sorry."
"Sure," he said. They stood in the dark and tried to see each other's faces. "You know about Ken?"
"Yes. I'm sorry I didn't know about your mother in time to get to the funeral."
"It's just as well. You didn't know her." The bitterness wouldn't be kept out of his voice. She turned, and he caught her face in the half-light coming from the street through the window. What he saw made him intensely sad. It wasn't sorrow or despair or anxiety, but the lack of these or any other readable emotions. Her lovely face was empty, even immobile. "I'm sorry to keep you standing like this. Do come in, please." Grasping her elbow firmly, he led her to the kitchen. Emmy sat down without removing her coat and watched as Ichiro glumly resumed his game of solitaire.
"I'm getting a divorce from Ralph," she said.
"Does he know?"
"He asked me to get one."
"I'm sorry."
"Why?"
"Oh, I don't know. Seems a shame, that's all. I guess Ken never got around to finishing that letter."
"I hardly think it would have done any good," she said.
"Don't love him anymore?" She crumpled a ball of Kleenex and dabbed at her nose.
"It's been too many years to talk about love."
Son of a bitch. That wasn't what he was feeling, but only what he thought. Yet, how was he to say to her that a girl like her deserved a better deal than the rotten one that she had gotten? That a lot of guys, including himself, would give a right arm for a woman like her? He said again, mostly in despair. No good son of a bitch.
"Please,"
she said, and she was close to tears. "Sorry," he said hastily. Then he added, "This is sure the time for being sorry. Sorry this, sorry that. Why'd you come?"
"I heard about your mother. I wanted to see you."
"I'm glad you came. I hadn't expected to see you again, and really, it's very funny because there's no one else I can talk to."
"Mr. Miano asked about you. He's still looking for someone to work for him."
"No."
"Oh."
"I've got a pretty good line on the job. I'm seeing about it tomorrow." He raked up the cards when the game wouldn't come out, shuffled, and started to lay out a new game.
"Stop, please."
She put a hand over his. "Sorry." He grinned at the word, then used his free hand to unfold hers. "It'll be nice for the fellows to have you back in circulation."
"Really?"
She didn't sound pleased at all. "Sure. You're still young, pretty. No, you're more beautiful than pretty. You've got a lot to offer any man. Ralph's a damn fool, besides being a son of a bitch."
"Don't."
"Okay. But he is." Talking, she slipped her hand unobtrusively from between his and back onto her lap.
"I've been lonely a long time, Ichiro. I didn't realize how much until that night you stopped in and gave me word about Ken, and then hinted you might not be seeing me anymore. Then when Ralph's letter came, I really began to suffer from it. I've got to do something or go crazy."
"It takes time," he said, knowing that it meant nothing.
"Come and see me,"
she pleaded. "I'm no good for you. No good for anybody."
"Why? Why do you say that?" true, that's why.
It isn't. It isn't. It isn't.
And now she was sobbing quietly. He drew a handkerchief from his pocket and put it in her hand. Emmy sniffled into it and wiped her eyes, trying hard to compose herself.
I'll be going, she said.
Without looking at her, he started to lay out a new game.
It was after Ken was dead, and Ralph's letter had come, and I was feeling so lonely,
said Emmy.
I was thinking then how nice it would be to go dancing, like a long time ago. I was hoping you would come and take me out. You see how it is? Thoughts of a little girl.
Let's go, he said suddenly.
Where?
Dancing.
But your mother?
She's nothing. I ran out on the funeral. That's how it is.
No,
she said stubbornly.
Not tonight. It wouldn't be right.
Nonsense. What's more right than two young people going dancing because they feel like it? He straightened his tie and hustled into his overcoat. She seemed to want to protest further, but said no more. Come on. Taking her arm in his, they walked together out of the store and to her Ford, parked at the curb. Once in the car and on their way, they felt relaxed and free and happy. Where to? He said gaily.
Wherever you wish, she replied.
The only place he could think of was the Trianon in Midtown, and it disturbed him because it was likely that he might run into some people there that might know him. He drove slowly, trying to think of some other places. Then it occurred to him that he couldn't help finding some place by driving along one of the busier highways going out of the city. He headed south, feeling the snug warmth of Emmy close to him, and immensely grateful that she had come to offer her condolences. They didn't say much either in the car or after they found a sizable roadhouse and started dancing to a smooth six-piece orchestra. He was enjoying it, and he felt that Emmy was too. This is the way it ought to be, he thought to himself. To be able to dance with a girl you like, and really get a kick out of it, because everything is on an even keel, and one's worries are only the usual ones of unpaid bills and sickness in the family and being late to work too often. Why can't it be that way for me? Nobody's looking twice at us. Nobody's asking me where I was during the war, or what the hell I am doing back on the coast. There's no trouble to be had without looking for it. Everything's the same, just as it used to be. No bad feelings except for those that have always existed and probably always will. It's a matter of attitude. Mine needs changing. I've got to love the world the way I used to. I've got to love it and the people so I'll feel good, and feeling good will make life worthwhile. There's no point in crying about what's done. There's a place for me and Emmy and Freddie here on the dance floor, and out there in the hustle of things if we'll let it be that way. I've been fighting it and hating it, and letting my bitterness against myself and Ma and Pa and even Taro throw the whole universe out of perspective. I want only to go on living and be happy. I've only to let myself do so. Hanging close to each other until the last note was gone, they slowly returned to the table to sit out the next, or until they should again feel like dancing. They smiled at each other, for there really was nothing to be said. Ichiro saw a man coming toward them as he lit his cigarette. He was not a young man, and he was slightly drunk. A few tables away, he bumped into a chair and had to apologize, but he didn't take his eyes from Ichiro and Emmy, and he kept on coming.
Pardon my intrusion, he said, smiling affably.
Yes? The skepticism was heavy on Ichiro's face. He felt the heat rising within him as he tried to adjust himself to what he felt was coming.
I saw you and want to buy you both a drink.
There's no need, really,
said Emmy pleasantly.
There is,
he said, his voice rising suddenly. Because I want to. Is that a good enough reason or isn't it?
Sure it is.
Ichiro relaxed. The man was obviously all right.
Fine. No, don't ask me to sit down. All I want to do is buy you a drink, okay?
Okay.
Pleased, the man went back to his own companions and, a little while later, the waiter came to take the order for the drinks. They sipped them, eyeing each other quizzically, and looking once or twice at the table of the man, who, as far as they knew, didn't look at them the rest of the time they stayed.
What do you think?
Asked Emmy. Ichiro rubbed his finger over a wet spot on the table. I think the man had a lot of Japanese friends once. Maybe he was a produce buyer or something and he misses the ones who didn't come back.
That's no good, she said.
I think, he started again. He had a son in that outfit that got surrounded up in the mountains by the Germans and was finally liberated by the Japanese boys. Emmy smiled.
No good.
I think he's a Japanese who's lucky enough not to look Japanese and feels sorry every time he sees a Jap that looks like one.
That's even worse.
He took the butt of his cigarette and knocked off the glowing end into the ashtray. I want to think, he said soberly, that he saw a young couple and liked their looks and felt he wanted to buy them a drink and did.
You keep on thinking that. That's how it was.
They rose, embraced, and moved out onto the dance floor. He probably had his eye on you, he said.
Sure,
she said.
Other women they look at and undress. Me, they undress and put in bed. It's something about me.
Keep talking, he said, feeling immensely full and wanting that moment to last a lifetime. He didn't get home until 3 o'clock, but the kitchen light was on. The old man, quite sober, was busily tying up several large packages. Japan?
Yeah, Ichiro. I send tomorrow.
He hung up his coat and sat and watched. I felt sick. I just couldn't stay for the rest of the funeral, Pa.
That is all right. Mama understands.
He worked the heavy twine carefully around a brown package and motioned with his chin for Ichiro to lend a finger. You'll be lonesome, Pa, huh?
Not so much. Mama was not well. It is better this way.
He pulled vigorously at the knot, almost catching Ichiro's finger. You plan to keep the store?
Yeah, it is just right for me. Maybe I fix up a little bit. Paint the shelves, a better cash register. Maybe I think I buy a nice white showcase for the lunch meat and eggs and things.
That'll cost money.
Yeah, but I have. Mama was saving for Japan. She went for nothing. After a while, I go for nothing too.
Sweating a bit from the effort of tying the packages, he wiped his brow with a clean handkerchief and sat down to pen the addresses. He seemed uncommonly contented for a man who had just lost his wife. He was still wearing the new blue suit, as if he couldn't take the time to remove it before starting to work on the packages. Ichiro watched his father, detecting an insuppressible air of enthusiasm and bubbling glee as he scratched in the names and addresses in both English and Japanese in several places on each package. There were 4 in all. The packages were the symbol of his freedom in a way. He no longer had just to think about sending them. It was his will to send them, and nothing was any longer to prevent his doing so. He had no visions about Japan, or about a victory that had never existed. While he might have been a weakling in the shadow of his wife, he was a reasonable man. He knew how things were, and he was elated to be able, finally, to exercise his reasonable ways. Above all, he was a man of natural feelings, and that, he felt, had always been the trouble with his wife. She tried to live her life and theirs according to manufactured feelings. It was not to be so.
"Do you ever think about life?"
he asked his son suddenly.
"What?"
"Yeah, that was too sudden," he said smilingly. "I meant only to say that one must live in the real world. One must live naturally, not so? It is not always a happy life, but sad or happy, it can be a good life. It is like the seasons. It cannot always be fall. I like the fall."
"Sure, Pa. That makes sense." The old man piled the packages neatly on the table and admired them.
"You take time, Ichiro. There is no hurry. I do not understand everything that is troubling you. I feel only that it is very big. You give it time. It will work out. After a while, maybe, you go to work or go to school if you wish. It can be done. You have a bed. There is always plenty to eat. I give you money to spend. Take time, yeah?"
"Sure, Pa. I'm not worried."
"So? Good."
And his lips trembled a little. And Ichiro felt that it was because the old man was finally doing and saying what he should have long ago, and knew that it was too late. "I'm seeing about a job tomorrow," he said, heading for the bathroom.
"Yeah, that is good. That is good."
Sitting there, contemplatively, he started to work the tie loose from his neck. 10. It was a sort of morning that non-Seattleites are always ascribing to Seattle. Wet without being really wet. And the whole city enveloped in a kind of dull, grayish, thin fog. The rain was there, a finely speckled spray which one felt against the skin of one's face, and which clung to water-resistant garments like dew on a leaf. The temperature was around 40, and the clammy chill of the air seeped through the outer coats and past the undergarments and sucked the warmth from the very skin. Emerging from the stifling heat of the bus, Ichiro shivered and walked briskly down the hill toward the lake. Through the mid-morning haze, he saw the great length of yellow-painted fence proclaiming in red letters as tall as a man that everything beyond, the disreputable, patched-up, painted shacks and buildings, the huge pile of scrap, the freshly scrubbed trucks, the sad men and women, were of that charitable community known as the Christian Rehabilitation Center. At the gate, he inquired of a burly fellow sitting in a tiny guardhouse the way to the offices. The man pointed in the general direction of a cluster of garage-like wooden structures. Ichiro stood there, showing by his expression that the directions weren't at all sufficient. The man pulled his arm out of the rain and sat down so that all Ichiro could see was the top of his head. Walking close to the side of the roadway so as to benefit from the protection of the eaves, he ambled in the direction pointed out to him. There were stalls along both sides, where the rejected items from 1,000 attics and basements had been sorted out in a semblance of order and put out for the inspection of the bargain-hunting public. The junk was piled on tables, crammed into bins, hung from walls and ceilings, and pushed out into the drizzling rain. There were attendants to be seen, mean-looking men and women, whose sole object seemed to be that of seeking out precious, overlooked cracks and corners into which more junk could be squeezed. They were like the junk, patched and refinished
but with the wasted best years irrevocably buried. Neither they nor the antiquated, scarred, and barely salvaged items that they pushed about would ever see good days again. Past the stalls was an expanse of open ground, on which the junk was in the form and shape of yellowed iceboxes and ancient washing machines and huge stacks of iron beds and odds and ends of clumsy rusted machinery and tangled heaps of pipes and one dilapidated 2.5-ton army truck, minus tires and wheels and a fender and the motor. An old man in a long black raincoat sat on the truck bed with legs dangling over the end. Beside him was a small pile of tools, and he sat smoking his pipe as if he were out soaking up a bit of sunshine. His eyes, almost obliterated by bushy eyebrows and deep wrinkles, followed Ichiro's progress patiently.
"What'll you have?"
he shouted. "Nothing, Pop."
"Got some fine refrigerators, dirt cheap. I know. I fix 'em."
"I'm not buying today."
"How about a washing machine? Got one in yesterday that's a honey."
Picking up a screwdriver, he pointed behind him. "How much?"
"I thought you weren't buying."
"I'm not."
"Why you asking?"
"For the hell of it."
"You're cute,"
replied the old man, his whole face wrinkling further into a big smile.
"Don't happen to have a drink on you, have you?"
Not bothering to answer, Ichiro continued along his way. He had now reached the buildings which, from the gate, had looked like garages, and was surprised to see that they were workshops. Through the windows, he saw men fixing and painting furniture, repairing tricycles and wagons, upholstering sofas, sorting rags and baling them into enormous rectangular bundles, and groups of women sewing and cutting and patching and cleaning clothing and curtains and rugs and bedding. They all looked warm and comfortable and satisfied. There was a sign on the end of one of the buildings saying, "Administrative Offices," with a red hand pointing over to his right. He took the corner and was mildly astonished at the sight of a new one-story brick building, with plenty of glass and surrounded by a border of young bushes. Pausing at the door, he fought the urge to turn back and forget about the job. He brushed his shoes across the large rubber mat and saw that the woman behind the desk in the lobby was smiling at him. He took his time, walking in slow, deliberate steps and concentrating on the smile so as not to get nervous. By the time he was close enough to speak to her, he was quite fascinated by the smile, which had remained precisely the same all the while he had been watching it. "Yes, young man?" She spoke quickly, almost sharply. It was then that he saw that her eyes were not smiling, and that the smile on her mouth was caused by a scar on one side of her face that tugged at the corner of her mouth so that she had not really been smiling at all. "I came about the job," he said. She pushed one of a half dozen buttons on a brown plastic box and lifted the phone to her ear. Waiting no more than a few seconds, she spoke. "Are you available for an interview, Mr. Morrison?" A pause. Then, "A young man. Japanese, I think." "Down the hall to your left," she said, pointing with one hand and replacing the phone with the other. "Mr. Morrison will see you." "Thanks." He walked down the hall, passing several unmarked doors. Confused, he halted and looked back at the woman. She was looking straight ahead, and he couldn't see the smile because it was on the other side of her face.
"Over here, fella,"
Mr. Morrison called, stepping out into the hallway a few yards still further down. He was tall, blonde, and wore a smart-looking blue suit. He motioned Ichiro into the office, saying,
"Have a chair. Be with you in a minute."
There was a desk, a filing cabinet, a typewriter on a metal stand, and two chairs. He sat down on the one in front of the desk.
It was several minutes before Mr. Morrison returned.
Otto Morrison, he said, with arm extended.
Thinking that the man couldn't be much over 30, Ichiro took the hand and said, Mine is Yamada, Ichiro Yamada.
Ichiro Yamada, repeated the man fluently. How do I pronounce it?
Good.
Ought to,
he said with obvious elation, as he skirted around the desk to his chair.
Spent 15 months in Japan. Ever been there?
No.
Too bad. Go if you ever get a chance. Fine country. Fine people. Nihongo ga wakarimasu ka?
A little bit.
I speak it pretty good myself. Only way to get to know the people is to learn the language, I say. I learned it, and I got to know them. I was there before the war, thanks to my dad. He did a lot of business there.
He offered Ichiro a cigarette and put one in his own mouth.
Now, tell me something about yourself.
Not much to say. I need a job. I heard there might be one here.
Someone who works here?
No, a friend of a fellow who works here. You know Gary?
Sure thing. Gary's a fine worker, a real artist. He does the signs on our trucks.
Opening the center desk drawer, Mr. Morrison withdrew a 5x7 card and neatly lettered Ichiro's name on the top. He asked the usual questions concerning parents, address, education, special abilities, and noted the answers in the same neat manner on the lines below. Then, since a question which needed to be asked wouldn't come out quite as easily as he had hoped, he made a pretense of studying the information on the card. Ichiro squirmed, and Mr. Morrison smiled reassuringly and studied the card some more. Finally, he said,
Gary has a problem, you know.
Ichiro looked up, not quite understanding at first, but quickly grasping what Mr. Morrison was trying so hard to make as painless as possible for both of them.
My problem is the same one, he said, in a very level voice.
I see.
A look of disappointment crept over his face. To erase it quickly, lest Ichiro notice, he tried to smile, but, failing, rose hastily and turned about to gaze out the window.
Nasty day, he said emptily.
I know, said Ichiro, sharing the man's discomfort.
I'm sorry, said Mr. Morrison, settling back into his chair.
He smiled but with a weariness, which made him appear for the moment an old man.
If the question is impertinent, say so. But tell me, if you will, why you didn't comply with the draft.
That's a good question.
Don't you know?
He sounded almost angry. Not exactly, Mr. Morrison. The evacuation, the camp, my parents, all of it, and then some, I guess.
Have you any regrets?
Yes.
You're sorry, then?
Yes.
Sure you are.
He slouched in his chair and folded his hands under his chin thoughtfully.
I like my work, Ichiro. I like it because I'm working with people and for people who need help. Drunks, morons, incompetents, delinquents, the physically handicapped. I've helped them all, and it gives me great satisfaction. But you and Gary, there's nothing wrong with you. You don't belong here. All I can do for you is give you a job and hope. That's what makes it tough. Hope is all right, but it's so much nicer when you can help it along. I can't do that for you. I've thought about it a lot, ever since Gary came. Youth, intelligence, charm, a degree in fine arts, health. He's got everything. So have you. Makes me feel damned useless. Both of you could step into 100 jobs out there in the city this very minute and do a more competent job than the people in them. Unfortunately, They never told me about a therapy for your kind of illness.
Well, he said, straightening up suddenly. No point in adding my woes to yours. How would you like to work with Gary?
I guess that would be all right.
It pays 35 a week. A little more later on, maybe.
He thought of the 260 a month offered to him by Mr. Carrick in Portland only a week before. I should have taken it, he thought.
If Ma had been dead then, I would have. It would have been work that I would have liked. It could have led to something. Mr. Carrick would have been nice to work for. A lot of things could have been, only they weren't. Morrison isn't to be blamed for being young and disturbed. He means well. He's doing the best he can.
That's enough for me,
he answered.
No need to say yes right this minute, of course.
Well, I would like to think some about it.
Sure. Let me know in a few days.
I will.
Mr. Morrison rose and came around the desk to shake his hand once more.
Stop by and chat with Gary long as you're here. He can tell you more about the job than I can.
Fine.
Take the side door to your right. You can't miss him.
Thanks, Mr. Morrison. I'll let you know.
The man held on to his hand all the way out to the hallway. It seemed as if he were reluctant to let Ichiro go, for not having done more. He seemed to be searching for something adequate to say. Finally, shaking his hand vigorously a last time, he said with great enthusiasm,
I know you like working here. Maybe the three of us can find a solution to your peculiar situation. There's an answer to everything, you know.
Thanks,
he said again, and walked down the hall to the door. He found Gary up on a stepladder, working on the last I in the word rehabilitation, which was being painted on a huge green van. With deft, sure strokes of the brush, Gary applied the red paint, filling in the outline of the letter, which he had made with equal care. Not until he had completed it and leaned back to appraise his own work did he seem to notice that he was being watched. Still, he did not turn immediately. Brush in hand, he dabbed carefully twice before he looked satisfied. Then he turned toward the entrance and, recognizing Ichiro, frowned thoughtfully.
Hello,
said Ichiro, as Gary climbed down and came toward him.
Nice to see you, Ichi,
said Gary. They shook hands and Ichiro noticed that Gary still wasn't smiling, although he seemed friendly enough.
I was just in to see Morrison. He thinks he can fix it up for me to work here with you.
Fine,
said Gary.
Fine.
It occurred to him then that he was still holding the brush in his hand, and he walked to the back of the shop to place it in a can. He lingered there, fussing around with jars of paint and rags and shoving things into a semblance of order. Ichiro, slightly disconcerted by Gary's cool behavior, walked up to the truck and examined the lettering.
You're good. That's all right, he said.
Gary turned abruptly, and he suddenly grinned broadly.
What the hell?
He exclaimed.
You ought to kick me in the ass. Let's try again.
He extended his hand once more and shook Ichiro's vigorously.
If this is treatment number two, I like it better,
said Ichiro, greatly relieved. Gary took cigarettes from his shirt pocket, shook one half out of the pack, and offered it to Ichiro. They lit up and sat on a couple of boxes against the wall.
I heard you were out, said Gary.
Out?
Grinned Ichiro.
If this is what it's like being out, I wouldn't have been so anxious.
Standing up, Gary walked up to the truck and studied the unfinished job of lettering. He wasn't tall, but slender, with wide shoulders and strong, graceful arms and legs. He ran both hands through his thick, wavy black hair and stood poised for a moment with palms clasped behind his neck. Maybe it's a little easier for me, he said softly, as if to himself and, with back toward Ichiro, no longer aware of his presence.
I am a painter. That is, I think I am. I want to be a good painter, an artist. I'm painting now, but it wasn't always that way. Before, it was talk. Sitting over cold cups of coffee covered with cigarette ashes and talking about life and sex and philosophy and history and music and real art. And getting so all fire worked up that I was ready to run out into the black night and splash paint all over the side of a building in a burning frenzy of creation. But never moving, and continuing to talk and dream and sit like I had a lead weight in my hind end. It wasn't once in a while. It was all the time. Weeks, months, years, talking and squirming, and maybe working on canvas once in a long while. But only because you suddenly ran up against a day or night when absolutely nothing was going on, and not being able to paint because the lead weight in the behind was sniffing around for the chair that wasn't there. If I'd spent the time painting that I did talking, I might have had a painting now, a real painting. I wasted a lot of time. God, there's so much time that I've wasted.
Fingers tightening about his head, he squirmed as if in agony. Ichiro drew quietly on his cigarette and watched as the youthful figure worked the tension out of itself and started again to speak.
It was good, the years I rotted in prison. I got the lead out of my ass and the talk out of my system. I died in prison, and when I came back to life, all that really mattered for me was to make a painting. I came home and said hello to the family and tried to talk to them, but there was nothing to talk about. I didn't stay. I found a room next to the sky, a big drafty attic atop a dilapidated mansion full of boarders who mind their own business. Old friends are now strangers. I've no one to talk to, and no desire to talk, for I've nothing to say except what comes out of my paint tubes and brushes. During the day, I paint for my keep. At night, I paint for myself. The picture I want is inside of me. I'm groping for it, and it gives me peace and satisfaction. For me, the cup is overflowing.
He turned, and the piece he spoke of was clearly written on his face.
What was unfortunate for you was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Sure, said Ichiro, as he looked deep into his friend's eyes to detect the fear and loneliness and bitterness that ought to have been there, and saw only the placidness reflected in the soft, gentle smile.
I'm not crazy, said Gary.
I wasn't thinking that, said Ichiro, reassuringly.
It's just that I'm finally on the right track. If that makes me crazy, I won't argue about it.
If it's right for you, that's all that matters, I suppose. Going back to the work table to get his brush, Gary ascended the ladder and resumed lettering.
I've got to get this out before lunchtime, he said.
I might as well run along anyway, answered Ichiro.
Stay and watch if you like. It won't bother me.
It was nice seeing you again. He started to walk out.
Wait.
Gary jumped down off the ladder and walked up to Ichiro.
I'm sorry if I made you feel unwelcome when you came. It wasn't that at all. I'm just forgetting how to be sociable. I think we could get along very nicely working here.
Thanks. But I think my mind was pretty well made up before I came here. You can tell Morrison that I've decided to pass up his offer. Maybe I'll see you around.
Sure.
As he started out, he remembered Freddy's having mentioned Gary's brief period of employment at a foundry. He paused and, standing at the entrance, called back. Gary? He was beginning to climb the ladder, but stopped on the third rung and waited. What happened at the foundry?
Happened?
Yeah. Freddy said you had a good deal there. Gary smiled.
Fine fellow, that Freddy. He didn't tell you?
No. Descending to ground level, Gary came close to Ichiro.
I'm glad he didn't, seeing you have to know. He would have made it sound worse than it really was. It was a good job, a good deal as far as the money was concerned. The work was hard, of course. With overtime and all, I was taking home close to 100 a week. There were a number of vets at the same shop, even a couple I'd known pretty well at one time. They steered clear of me, made it plain that I wasn't welcome. But hell, I have to eat too. I guess they spread the word around because pretty soon, the white guys weren't talking to me either. Birdie knew about it too, but it didn't seem to matter to him. Birdie's a colored fellow. He took a liking to me. He let everybody know that anyone wanting to give me a rough time would have to deal through him. I heard he used to spar with Joe Lewis some years back. I had plenty of protection. I should have left then, I guess. But I figured if I got killed accidentally by a falling sewer pipe or had my brains mangled by a crowbar, maybe it was something I had coming to me. As I said, I feel like a guy that's come back from the dead. Living on borrowed time, you know. Makes one a bit anxious, of course. But there's a peace about it that takes away all the ordinary fears of getting hurt or dying. I kept on working, ignored but not minding it. Really, it didn't bother me one single bit. Birdie pretty near got into a couple of fights over me, but only because it seemed to bother him for some reason. I kept telling him not to go to bat for me, that I didn't mind not being spoken to or being called names, but he couldn't see how that could be. He was suffering for me, really suffering. There's still plenty of good people around, you know. Ichiro nodded, thinking of Kenji and Emmy and Mr. Carrick. There isn't much more to say, continued Gary quietly. I knew, if I stayed on, that something would happen to me. I could feel it building up in the awful quiet that kept getting bigger and meaner every day. And they sensed that I wasn't frightened, and that seemed to make it all the worse. Again, I say I should have left like a sensible individual. But I didn't. There was no guarantee that I wouldn't run into the same sort of thing someplace else. The way I saw the whole thing was that the worst they could do to me was to kill me. And, since that didn't make one bit of difference to me, why should I give up a good income? It was all too simple. Somebody was smart enough to figure that I'd probably show a little more concern for someone else.
Birdie?
Yes, the bastards. They loosened the lugs on his car. He lost a wheel going 50 miles an hour and rolled over 3 times.
He added, with a voice full of emotion.
Not a scratch. He got out clean.
They don't know what they're doing.
I shouldn't say that. They know too well what they're doing. Go for broke, you know. You've heard it.
Sure. Gary rubbed the wooden tip of the brush thoughtfully against his cheek.
This is a bad time. Bad for us, that is. The atmosphere is full of emotion. Too much of the heart, and not enough of the mind. Makes bastards out of good guys. Later on, things will soften down. Reality will make them lose some of their cocksureness. They'll find that they still can't buy a house in Broadmoor, even with 1,000,000 stones in the bank. They'll see themselves getting passed up for jobs by white fellows not quite so bright, but white. They'll take a trip up to some resort, thinking this is God's green land of democracy for which I killed 12 krauts,
and get kicked in the face with the unfortunate mistake about the reservation story because he'd signed the letter O'Hara, and the guy at the resort thought it was good old Irish O'Hara. Tough to have a name like O'Hara, and feel that maybe when they made up the batch of orders upstairs, one of the Lord's workers neglected the apostrophe, and so the guy turns up in the USA a Jap instead of an Irishman. That's beside the point, however. When they find out they're still Japs, they'll be too busy to be mean to us.
You really think there will come a time when what we've done will be forgotten?
I didn't say that. They'll forget. Some of the guys who have it real tough might even envy us secretly. Time will make them forget, but I'm not so sure that we will. Right now, I say the situation is highly emotional. They've gone all out to prove that their blood is as red as Jones's or Torgerson's or Mayo's or what have you. They've just got through killing and being killed to prove it. And I don't blame them one bit for not hesitating to kill us. You and I are big black marks on their new laundry.
What if it had turned out the other way?
Gary smiled. You run along home and talk to yourself about any ifs and buts about the thing. I only know what is. That's what we've got to live with.
Ichiro stretched out his arm and grasped Gary's hand firmly for a moment. I'll think about what you've said. Makes sense.
Good luck.
Thanks. He walked out of the garage and past the new building and around the workshops and up toward the gate, without seeing the old man still sitting on the truck that would never run again. The fine drizzle had turned to a steady rain and, waiting for the bus, he shivered slightly and noticed that he hadn't buttoned up his raincoat. With groping fingers, he worked the buttons into the holes as he gazed back down the hill at the shabby collection of buildings which he had just left. The rain pelted his head, worked into his hair, and dripped down the back of his neck. But he was like a man whose mind was momentarily detached from his physical being. He was thinking about the apostrophe, the topside comma, the period with the tail on it. It was the little scale on which hinged the fortunes of the universe. It was the slippery, bald-headed pivot on which man hung, unborn and unnamed, until suddenly he found himself squirming on one side or the other. It made a difference, of course, which side he chose to fall off on, but when a fellow can't see for the heavy clouds down below, he simply has to make up his mind in a hurry and hope for the best. Was that the erratic way of the Almighty? O'Hara, O'Hara? Lock up the apostrophes for a while. We've got too many Irishmen. He heard the bus, but wasn't quick enough to leap back as the wheels sloshed against the curb. The blackened spray clung to the front of his raincoat, and he made it worse by rubbing his hand over it. Getting on, he deposited his token and settled down in a seat next to a dozing man. It wasn't his fault. Neither was it the fault of his mother, who was now dead because of a conviction which was only a dream that blew up in her face. It wasn't the fault of the 500 million Chinamen who hated the 90 million Japanese and got only hatred in return. One only had to look about to see all the hatred in the world. Where was all the goodness that people talked about? The goodness of which there was never quite enough to offset the hatred. He recalled how he'd gone to a church in Idaho with Tommy, who was always reading the Bible. Tommy would say grace before he ate a lousy peanut butter sandwich out in the choking dust of the sugar beet field, when all the other guys were cussing and bitching and stuffing the bread into their dirty faces. They gave Tommy a bad time. Freddie had been with them too. He was the one who claimed he heard Tommy thanking God for the Sears Roebuck catalog one day, while squatting over the hole in the outhouse. Tommy didn't seem to mind. He just smiled, as if he understood it all. That's why he'd gone along with Tommy that day, instead of playing poker in the bunkhouse. If Tommy had the answers, he wanted to know about them. They had slipped into the church, where Tommy had already gone for several Sundays,
The service being in progress, they sat in the back. He sensed immediately that they weren't welcome. Tommy seemed not to notice at all the furtive glances and the unguarded whispering. He had been glad to get out of there, and, as they walked to the bus depot,